WTLS, score 94, hit 106. Wake up call continuing. And Harold Shedd, one of the greats in the music industry, producer in Nashville, longtime in Music City, joins us via the radio. And it's been a little while since we've had him on. He was on with us back when we had our 50th anniversary here. Of course, he got his start at WTLS, and he went on to great things. Harold, it's good to talk to you. I've enjoyed talking to you over the phone the last few weeks. We look forward to having you in the studio here soon. But we wanted to chat, and we got you on this morning. Good morning to you. Hope you're doing well.
Good morning, Michael. I'm happy to be with you again, and I look forward to seeing you in person again in the near future.
You know, it's been a little bit of time back, 2004, WTLS celebrated its 50th anniversary, and you were here. My grandfather was here. He's no longer with us. We miss him every day, my grandmother. But you worked with them, and it was good to see you come back and meet with some of those folks that worked at WTLS all those years. This is the place where you got your start back in the 1950s.
Yeah, I have nothing but fun memories for WTLS and Tallahassee and the surrounding area. Had a lot of good times and met a lot of really great people and still in contact with you and a few of the others still around. Of course, you were not on the scene originally, yeah. I guess, when I first started in the late 50s, but I have been able to spend some time with you and your dad and your grandfather. And it's just, Tallahassee is kind of like a home because it's where I started. I had a friend who had a full-time job at WTLS. And so he called me one time. We had been playing music in a band together. And we were making a living, but, you know, we weren't making any money. So he says, "We got a weekend spot open, and you might want to check it out if you don't mind working on Saturdays and Sundays." So, well, I was used to that, so it was not a big deal, and I did, and I went to Tallahassee, and I stayed there for some time until Ned and Mr. Hemphill and Mr. Johnson built a station up in Talladega, and I moved up there and worked for them for a long time, and had a great career in radio. Loved every minute of it, too.
You kind of alluded to the way it happened, that you coming over here. You lived in Georgia. You're from Bremen, Georgia. You're back in Georgia, living over there now.
I'm back in Bremen. Yeah. I've retired back to Bremen. Yeah.
So how does it open the door to Tallahassee, Alabama? How did that, and I know you had a friend that worked there. How did he get here, and how did he draw you in after that?
Well, he was our music guru at that time in Bremen and Harrelson County. And I played in his band and later formed my own band, and he played in my band. And we played music together for years and years. And of course, in this area, you don't make a lot of money because you don't have records and you don't have merchandise to sell or that people really want to buy. And from that standpoint, it was not lucrative, but it was a job. And it was also a way of doing something you love to do and make a living doing it, you know. And he ventured out and being the promoter that he was, he ventured out into radio land and wound up, I don't know how Lee actually wound up in Tallahassee, but he was working at WTLS, I believe in 1956 is when he first went there. And then I came a short time later because he informed me, you know, that there was a position open if I didn't mind working on the weekend. So that's how I got to Tallahassee.
You drove over, I guess you were still living in Georgia. Is that, so you just drive over and work your weekend shift?
Yeah,
is that the way it works?
Yeah, it's not a bad drive, you know, and I drive over on the weekends and work and come back home, and we were farmers and sharecroppers, so I was a farmer during the week and a radio announcer on the weekend, if you'll have it.
Yeah, and you, as you said, you're kind of getting in a band, and this is where the music connection started. I want you to tell us what it was like in the 1950s in Tallahassee. Your time here, you say, you know, was your first radio gig. What was radio like here at WTLS as well?
Well, radio, it was different. For one thing, the format was changing a lot in that tape, reel-to-reel tape was the main way of recording back then. And the 78 RPM records were being phased out, and 45s and the little records and the LPs were being recorded and shipped to radio a lot to try and, test out some of the ways of doing it as they went along. But we wound up with two fabulous turntables and playing 45 RPM records, the latest and the greatest at the time, and eventually went from reel to reel to tape cartridges. And in fact, your grandfather actually made the first tape cartridges we had in the studio. He was quite an engineer, as you know. He built radio stations. And he could build any kind of equipment that he set his mind to. Ned was a genius in that field, and he was just a great teacher. He taught us a lot about radio. He taught us a lot about programming and how to do it tastefully and where you would be believable enough that you would be able to select your own music that you played then. It was what we call block programming. We'd play an hour or two of country music and another hour or two of gospel music and then big band music also was part of the format. And then after school, say after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it would be some rock and roll because
yeah.
Rock and roll came along in the 50s and really became a viable format. And then country was somewhat there, but it didn't break big till the 50s and the 60s and 70s. So we had the best of all worlds in that we could have personal contact with our listeners, and they would tell us to some degree, you know, what they liked and what they wanted to hear. So having gone on from records and LPs and radio to recording in Nashville, it really was a big plus to have that kind of experience where you could actually select your own music and decide what people might want to hear or might like to hear.
It's something to go back and see the cusp of change that you were a part of yourself in that era and what music was. You know, it was the standards, Perry Como or something, and then it turns into Elvis Presley. You know, we had the report. John Culp worked there. I don't know if you ever crossed paths with him.
Yeah, John worked there when I worked there.
So he says, I always ask for a verification of this, and maybe you were around when it happened or remember him telling it, but he says Elvis Presley did stop by and drop off the record Mystery Train while he was a DJ here.
Well, that's very possible.
Yeah.
I was not there at the time he would have done that, but not in the station, but it's very possible because then – actually, artists would travel all over the country themselves,
yep.
Not just rock and roll, but country artists especially. You had one big country act in Tallahassee, a guy named Peck Rowell at that time, and he was a regional hit, but he didn't have the national distribution that some of the other acts had, and the affiliation with a major label that could do that for them. But we had a lot of talented people around Tallahassee at that time. So it wouldn't surprise me if Elvis stopped by on a promotional tour.
Yeah, I across the street was a hot hangout called Tubby's Place. Do you remember this place?
That's right. I remember Tubby, yes. Yeah, Tubby's was, it was the place in Tallahassee at the time. And a great restaurant, too, by the way.
Yes. Well, you know,
it was right across the road from the radio station when I worked there.
Yes, it was. I've heard all about it. You're the disc jockey playing the music there over there, dancing to it across the street, eating burgers, I guess.
Yeah, that could have been. Yeah, John Cupp worked there. Hank Holman worked there. Ed Wallace Hopgood worked there. Some other people that I can't recall. It'll take me a little time to bring all that up again. But, you know, I got to participate in two great events in music, and that was also after we started recording. We went from the 8-track format to the cassette format, and briefly to the DAT, and then to the CD format that's still around and is slowly, I guess, being replaced by streaming and some other ways of exposing music now. You got a lot of sites, I understand, Spotify and sites that you can go to for music. But I still love the old format. I love play my CDs, and I got to participate in all of those changes, and that was something to see at the time too.
Yeah, you know, you and my grandfather and grandmother remained friends. I just got a picture I sent to you by text this week of y'all at the beach. Y'all stayed friends throughout this time. You worked with him outside of Tallahassee at the other station in Talladega, as you mentioned, but you moved on and started doing some things on the other side, which was jingles and a music production company. Talk about that transition and how it led you to the next step, which would eventually get to Nashville.
Well, I worked for a company out of Memphis, and we did jingles for radio stations in the form of call letters and also production music. You know, before production libraries were available, we would take a great ending from a big band record and make an ending for a commercial and sometimes use some of the instrumental music for the voiceover. But then the jingle companies, a couple of them started, one being in Dallas and one in Memphis that I remember mostly about jingles. I worked for the Tanner Company out of Memphis, and at that time we were doing products for thousands of radio stations, and it led into my association and acquaintance with a man named Scotty Turner from Nashville, Tennessee, who was a co-writer of songs and worked for United Artists Records. And he was intrigued by the jingle business, and I met him, and he says, why don't you move to Nashville and we'll start our own jingle company. And at the time I was a salesman on the road and working with radio stations and some TV, but mostly radio. And I did. I moved to Nashville, and we started a little jingle company. We got off of the ground a little ways, but never became a factor, you know. And having a studio to work full-time in was the biggest plus from all that, in that it allowed us the opportunity to record people like Peck Rowell, who was looking to get some records made that he could afford, and distributed by a company out of Nashville, and we could do that. So it, if you'll have it, we kind of segued into making records from Jingle. So that's how that all came about. And then I started producing records independently, and after a few successes, was offered an opportunity at a major label, Mercury Records, and it led to my career as a record producer, and I got the opportunity then to record some of the artists that I wanted to record, and all of that came from the jingle business, Michael, all of it, and from radio and jingle business.
It's interesting that I did not know till recently. I was listening to one of your interviews on a podcast that you worked with Pepper Tanner, and now I know why we had stacks and stacks of Pepper Tanner jingles and stuff. We had a lot of them. We played them here for years at WTLS, but getting to Nashville led to all this success, and it all started with Alabama. And I just wanted you to listen to this. I know you've heard these many times, but I just put a montage of number one hits together. Only 23 in the 1980s that you produced for the group, and we've knocked it down to 2 minutes. So here is Alabama, the work by Harold Shedd.
Oh, Tennessee River. She's a lady down on love. And roll on 18-wheeler, roll on. When we make love, if you're gonna play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band. By the dark of the moon, there's a fire in the night. There's no way body to body. I fall in love again. Fall in love again. Into the wind.
You know, every single one of these records are not just good, they're great, and I still love to listen to all of them. Not a single one was a bad record. They're all outstanding. And you got to be proud about that. I know you had a part in that. You're in the studio while we're making all these hits. Every single one, I mean, went to number one. What do you think about when you hear that that many great songs?
Well, it's kind of chilling in a way, Michael. I've never heard that many of them back to back, for one thing. The group Alabama was the beginning of all that, and we had a wonderful career. I was with them for a decade, and went to a major record company to produce records and run the A&R and the label department. And then all of that, I have to tell you that making records also one of the main ingredients for me was having spent 13 years at radio and being connected to the listener, through radio and through being a disc jockey and through selling advertising and through working with radio stations in the jingle business, it really helped me a lot in the production of records. So it enabled me to do some things that the average guy might not have been able to do because of the experience that I had. I signed some incredible acts and combined total sales. They're on up there now, and around 600-700 million records and sold. And Alabama's at about 100 million, and Toby Keith is about 100 million. And Shania Twain is about 100 million. And then Mel Tillis and Glenn Campbell, Reba McEntire, KT Osland, Kentucky Headhunters, Billy Ray Cyrus. Add them all up, and it's something to get your head around. Being a sharecropper and a farmer like I was, but by the same token, people are people, and there are a lot of good people, a lot of great people, and a lot of music lovers, and that's the most important part of it. Still, to me, I still love music. I listen to music. I listen to my radio when I travel, and I've not been traveling much in the last few months, but I will again. In fact, I'm going to come see you, hopefully, sooner rather than later, and I look forward to visiting, and we'll talk about all of this some more. I don't want to bore your audience with
but
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and talk about it, and thank you for the little collage of music there too. That was uplifting.
Yeah. What do you listen to, by the way? You say you still like to listen to music. Do you listen to stuff you did in the studio, or do you have favorites? What's
well,
on that list?
Sometimes, but I listen to everything. I listen to country, and I listen to some gospel music. I love, you know, country and gospel and blues is kind of what made up our music, and so I listened to all of that. My uncles, a lot of them played in big bands, so I listened to a lot of big bands from the 30s and 40s. I still like, music from that era because I was born in 31, and I grew up listening to big band music and the Grand Ole Opry. So those were the two main things we listened to when I was a kid. And my father was a minister, so we sang gospel music and church music every week. So all of that, I still listen to all of that. I love music, and I love all different kinds of music, actually.
On the Alabama run, 23 records were number one that you produced. Just about
21.
And 21 in a row, 23 in all. So when you put out the first one, Tennessee River, you guys get that number one, and then the number one, and another, and another, and another. I mean, what are you thinking as these things going out? I mean, I guess it mounts some pressure, too, to be at the top, but it was obviously no sweat for you.
There's a certain amount. However, you have some relief in that once you've had two or three hits, the publishers and writers in Nashville, they start pitching you the best they have. You know, everybody wanted to be on an Alabama record and so on, and a Mel Tillis record and KT Osland record and Glenn Campbell record. Everybody wanted to be on a big record, so you get to hear the best they have before anyone else hears it. So you really have that option that if you're just making your first record on a new artist, you don't necessarily get the best songs every time, you know.
How much time do you put into just one record? our song, and then, you know, putting that album together. How much effort goes into that usually?
Well, it takes a while. The more time you can spend, you know, sometimes the better they are, and if your budget determines some of that, and then again, sometimes you'll go in and normally a session is 3 hours long, and sometimes you'll cut two or three songs in that 3 hours that are just the best, you know, and as opposed to the better the song, this is the way I always look at it, the better the song, the better the record, you know, and a famous producer told me one time, Larry Butler, he's passed away now, but he produced Kenny Rogers records, and he says, give me a great song and I'll make you a great record. And that's a good way to look at it. You know, if the song is really great, then the record probably is going to be great. If it's a hit, it's going to be a hit. It's a combination of things, and it takes a while sometimes to do that, and sometimes you can do it in a day or two. But from start to finish, we worked on an album probably average a month, I guess.
It's a collaborative effort, and I know that you had your part in that. How much say do you have when you're putting this together? This needs to be in here, this instrumentation, and I always like the full document of, you know, like strings you would put into a song or so. I mean, I don't think people realize how much goes into just one song. So how much play did you have in that? How much was that? Was Alabama?
Well, Alabama wrote a lot of their hits, as you know, and that also makes it easier for a producer because you're not searching and listening every spare minute to a tape from some unknown writer or publisher, and sometimes that's where your better things come from because they don't have access to producers and musicians and publishers and you just take that approach to it. You do the best with what you have at the time, and sometimes it takes a few days to compile 10 great songs, and sometimes it takes a few months to do that, you know. So you have to work at it diligently from that standpoint, and the better your records are, the more songs you have to select from, if that makes any sense to you.
Who's picking what gets sent out, single releases? Is that you? Is that the group? Do y'all know which ones are the best ones and which ones will get released?
Well, that's usually a combination. Sometimes it's obvious, you know. There are exceptions. Sometimes it's a combination of the artist, the producer, the promotion and marketing people at the label. They all get involved in it now. Pretty much because things change and styles change as you go along, and you don't have hits on radio without marketing and promotion, so they have a part in that also.
What songs are at the top of the list? Now, this is always hard to pick your favorites. My gosh, there's so many good ones. But for the group Alabama, for instance, are there some that just stand out for you that you really like more than any other?
Well, you know, you have to like Tennessee River because it was the first number one.
Yep.
But My Home's in Alabama also was played like a number one record. It never reached number one in the charts. But Feel So Right, Dixieland Delight, Love in the First Degree, Lady Down on Love, Why Lady Why. It's hard to pick a favorite.
Any that you didn't like, you say, well, I don't know about this one, but it still becomes a big hit. Any stand out like that?
you got to like that, you know.
Yeah.
He's not like that. But I made a lot of records that I really liked. I made a record on K.T. Osland, 80s Ladies.
Yes.
And another song called I'll Always Come Back. And another song called Hey Bobby. And Do You.
Yep.
All great records. And and they were great songs. So here again, a great song, you can make a good record.
It's unprecedented that you had the 21 in a row with Alabama. It stopped with Tar Top, a song that reached the top 10 but didn't get to number one. Really an biographical account of the group, I guess. Was that one that you felt like, well, okay, this is not going to make it, but it's still a top 10 hit, and it's like the expectations were off the charts. What did you think about that one, and when the finally 21 straight number ones comes to a close?
Well, you know, Randy was a writer on that song also, and a writer on the other 20 songs, a lot of them, not all of them, but probably half of them, you know, and... So you take all of that into consideration, and we didn't realize what we didn't think about records at that time. Well, we've got so many, we got never thought about it really at that time, believe it or not. But we were just thinking about getting another hit on the radio, and it was disappointing, but it was not a thing that was devastating. It's we're in the record book. Nobody has ever done more than we did in that sense. The record at the time we hit 21 was 16 or 17, and it was held by Sonny James, another guy and a great artist and a great gentleman from Alabama too. So he was at our party when we celebrated that event, and he said, well, if I've got to lose my place, I'm glad it's to some guys from Alabama. So he was very gracious, and he held that record for a long time. And Alabama's held the record now for some time, and it'll be hard to knock them out, because everything they did was strong musically. They loved good songs, and then they knew a good song from a bad one. So it was my job with them was to create an atmosphere where they could do their music, and that's what we did.
Did they have a signature tune if you had to pick just one?
I guess the biggest, there were a couple of big selling records. Fields for Right was a big selling record, and so was Take Me Down.
Yeah.
That they didn't write. It was one of the biggest selling records, and you got to put, and why it's so hard to do just one, you got to put Christmas in Dixie.
I was just thinking about that one, yeah. I mean, because that one comes back every year.
It still gets played year after year, and it's right out of the chute, it sold 2 million records, just the single. So I don't know how many albums it sold, but it's in the millions.
And that's one of those, Harold, that gets played on every radio station during Christmas time, doesn't it? It doesn't matter if it's country, rock, or anything.
It does a few times, Michael. I guess everyone plays it several times in November and December.
Yeah, we do. I know that. It's you've had crossover hits, though. The songs that charted on both charts, the Billboard Hot 100, as well as country, of course. But you know, when I think of the signature ones, I probably think of like Dixieland Delight or Mountain Music. It seems like those songs are played everywhere. If you go to a ball game, you're going to hear Dixieland Delight and Alabama football games and things like that. I don't know how much you pay attention to that kind of thing or not, but it's there's staying power.
I pay attention to it, yeah. Dixieland Delight was such a great record. It was. And Love in the First Degree was also.
Yeah.
Got to put it in there. And And Why Lady Why was a real good record. And the Lady Down on Love was a real... We had... speaking of making records, we spent a little more time on that record because originally, or initially, I should say, we were trying to do a bigger production than it required. And finally, Randy and I were talking in the studio on a playback, just listening to what we were doing, and asked him how he did it. He did it live. He was doing it live in Myrtle Beach before we ever recorded it, you know. And he said that the most response he got was when he did it, just he and his guitar on stage, just he and his guitar. So that's the way we cut the initial track, and then I built the track around that. I put the strings and the percussion and some rhythmic things and the harmonies and that's the initial track was just Randy and his guitar. So we made the record from that. And if you could take the vocal off and just listen to the strings, the arrangement of the strings on that particular song was just as good as it gets.
Oh yeah,
you know.
You still keep in contact with Randy and I know with Teddy. But obviously, you lost Jeff. Sad news recently.
Yeah, lost Jeff a couple of weeks ago, and I talked to Randy and to Teddy. I talked to Teddy more than Randy because we spent more time together in the studio. Teddy is responsible for the harmonies being as good as they are.
Yeah.
He spent hours. We spent all day and sometimes and all night, you know.
Yeah, we would say it was an amicable parting, I guess, because you guys, you had an opportunity that you really, I guess, couldn't refuse. We were going to be a president of a record label, and you decided to take that position when that all kind of ended in the late 80s. So, but kind of tell how that came about.
Well, I was independently. I was doing, I was doing some things that other people weren't doing, and that was finding artists and making hit records. And I was doing Reba McEntire at the time and KT Osland. And I had signed Mel Tillis, who was already established. I was doing records with Mel, and through that association, he was friends with Glenn Campbell, and he said, "I want you to meet my friend Glenn. I want you to make some records with him." And so I met Glenn, and we did. I did two albums on Atlantic Records with Glenn, And so I got offered a contract to go to Mercury. And at the time, I'd been with Alabama for a decade, and they were up for Group of the Decade. So it just seemed like the right time for me to move on and leave on a high note. And that we did, and they'll always be my favorite band, and some of the things we did, I don't think will ever be outdone, if you'll have it. But working at a major record company was a good move for me. It afforded me the opportunity, you know, to explore and do some things that had not been done. Billy Ray Cyrus is one of them. The Kentucky Headhunters, Sammy Kershaw, and we were able to take Kathy Mattea to Female Vocalist of the Year for 3 years in a row, and just some things that were challenging, and but turned out very well. And when I left Mercury, I left them with Toby Keith and Shania Twain, and they're still two of the biggest artists in music today.
No doubt. Now, you've given me plenty of time this morning, but I wanted you to listen to one more sampling of some of those songs from those new artists after Alabama.
Faithless love. Like a river flow.
How blue can you make me?
Walk softly on this heart of mine, love.
Now we're ladies, there ain't been much these ladies ain't tried.
Should have been a cowboy, I should have learned to row.
It wasn't just Alabama. There was plenty more that you worked with during the time with the group, as well as afterwards with the new label. And I just want to say it was amazing. Is Billy Ray Cyrus's Achy Breaky Heart the biggest hit, though, maybe that you had a part in?
It is one of the biggest records we ever had.
Wow.
It pre-sold more records than most record sale. You know, it was. I don't know. I guess it was a time and a place, and all the stars lined up for that one. It was unreal.
You know, you were asked a question that I heard again on another recording of an interview, that who's the biggest star maybe you produced, and I think you mentioned Billy Ray, and you gave a reason. What was that reason?
Oh, I don't recall.
I think you said something about ladies throwing their panties up on the stage or something.
Oh, well, that goes back to Elvis there now.
Yeah.
That was a dead giveaway. You know, I saw Elvis in 1957 at the Fox Theater in Atlanta, Georgia, with Lee Williams. Lee and I went to see Elvis, and I had never seen anything like that before, you know, that where ladies actually threw things on the stage that they were wearing. And the only other time I ever saw that in my career, and I'm on up there, I'm 91 now, and I was in Ashland, Kentucky to see a young man named Billy Ray Cyrus. And this was about 1989, I guess, 89 or 90, early 90, late 89. And my general manager at Mercury and I flew up to Kentucky to see this young guy. And he'd been knocking on my door for some time and sending me demo tapes and not musically that impressive, you know, but we went in to see him, and I mean, the ladies were up on tables. They were doing I thought we were at an Elvis concert, you know, and it just blew me away. And I couldn't believe it was true, for one thing. So we came back to Nashville, and, I rented a bus. We took the promotion, marketing, and A&R staff, and all of us went back to Kentucky to see him at a different venue, different occasion, and it was the same reaction again. So everybody, you know, is just in awe. And so not being totally convinced again, I kind of did my disguise and slipped in where no one knew anyone was coming from any kind of record company in Nashville. So it was the same thing. And that's when I I came back and I called him and told him to come in, and I wanted to structure a little deal for him if I could, of some sort, and see what we could do. And well, lo and behold, Billy Ray came in and actually slept in the parking lot of the studio the night before we were meeting because he didn't want to be late for the meeting. And he came a day early.
Wow.
And we met, and he was just so impressive, you know, and he had that star quality, if you know what I mean. Some people can sing, but some people are stars, you know, and like Toby and Shania, they're stars because they are BMI's two biggest money makers. And they are bona fide stars. You know, Should Have Been a Cowboy, you just played a little of that.
Yep.
Has been played over 7 million times.
Incredible.
So that's pretty incredible, Michael. You can write that down. That's,
yeah, how many songs have that many spins on airwaves? Not many, I would think. I think about Shania Twain because I got to go see her in a concert, and she was great. I mean, like you say, she's a star. And musically, I enjoyed the music as well. But it's quite the run.
She and Mutt Lange took some what I would call mediocre songs and made big hits out of them, you know? So she is right behind Toby in total sales.
Yeah, it's just a unbelievable run that you guys had when you worked with all of those different people, and we've enjoyed talking to you. You gave me more time. I told you 15 minutes. I think it turned into 45.
Well, but, I could talk to you all day about
well, that's on
music.
Me.
I love music, man, and I appreciate you letting me visit with you.
Yeah, anytime, and I look forward to seeing you when you can get over this way. Please do, and we'll talk then, all right?
Okay. Next time we'll talk 20 minutes.
We will. Thank you, Harold. Thanks so much, and enjoy the rest of your day. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Bye.
There you are. Harold Shedd, a great producer, unbelievable run in this business, and got his start right here in Tallahassee, Alabama, at WTLS. We'll take a timeout. More coming up.